And you're representing yourself. And Mr. Maloney? Good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before you begin? Ms. Partouche, you understand you have 10 minutes and you can reserve part of that for rebuttal if you wish. And you can approach and proceed. And are you sure you don't have any other questions before you begin?
Yes, please.
Very good.
The oral argument of Jamie Partouche.
And before you, I'm going to interrupt you. Do you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Do I need to tell you how much?
That would be helpful, yes.
2 minutes, please?
2 minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
I appreciate that.
You're ready to go.
My name is Jamie Partouche. I am the appellate. I request the court reverse the district court's decision and remand to the district court for further proceedings. May it please the court. A public official is an agent of the public and therefore has an obligation of duty to their responsibility of serving documents on the appellant. The appellant was removed from her home without notice upon being served a granted protection order without notice and without notice of hearing or without notice of protection order. The appellant had not been notified or served of the show cause hearing.
Let me ask you. The heart of your argument is that you, in fact, did not receive notice of the hearing, right?
Correct.
Don't we have in our record a sheriff's return saying that you were served?
I believe there's a record saying that I was served on the at removal, so after it was granted. And during the proceeding, I don't know if that's on the transcript, I can look if I need to, but the judge said in the computer system, it did mention something about, it mentions it's being, it had been served on address.
Let's suppose, for purposes of your argument today, that the record contains a sheriff's return saying that you were personally served, not just address service, but personally served on February 22. Did you do anything in the trial court to dispute or try to contradict that return of service?
Yes.
And how did you do that?
I submitted within 10 business days, actually the same day or the day after I was removed. I contested the protection order.
And I'm not asking about contesting the protection order. Uh-huh. I'm asking, did you take any steps to challenge the accuracy of the sheriff's return?
I hadn't heard of a sheriff's return other than during the following show cause hearing, in which I was told I would present the reason why I was contesting the protection order that I did within 48 hours, basically. And that was after I was removed from the residence, from my household. And I presented that on March 10th in the show cause hearing, the other show cause hearing, as I was directed by the protection order office and within the legal advice that I had been given. Because I wasn't given a show cause hearing and wasn't aware of a show cause hearing prior to the protection order being granted.
I'm still not sure what, if anything, you did to try to challenge the sheriff's return that said you were personally served. Was there any motion to quash? Any motion to set aside that return of service, anything of that nature?
I contested being served via written notice to the court at the protect and by phone with the protection order office, and was given a show cause hearing. I was told I would be given that information during the show cause hearing, at which time the Honorable Judge Hanson said that she isn't supposed to hear that information at that show cause hearing, and hadn't been aware or did not know why I had been told to present those arguments or present that information on March 10th at that show cause hearing.
Just so I understand the timeline of it, the record shows that you were personally served on February 22nd. That was for the show cause hearing that was set for February 24th.
Correct.
You did not appear at the February 24th hearing.
Correct.
A protection order that was then entered as a result of your failure to appear in the filing of the application for protection order. You were then served with the protection order. Is that correct?
Correct.
And that's when you filed or talked to a protection order office or somebody of that nature?
I had already been in communication with the protection order office about the protection order I was filing.
Okay.
And I was instructed that I needed to wait for 3 incidents before I filed my protection order. Okay. And during the event, before, I was basically handed a document saying I was being served in my purse as I'm told that I'm having to leave. There was a gentleman. And
what day was that?
On the 24th of February.
Okay.
That's the first time I received any document directly to me, and it was testified by the appellee that he was told by the sheriff's office or whoever to hand the document or give me the document or tell me of the hearing.
So as a result of that, receiving that document on the February 24th date is when you filed your objection to the protection order or this additional show cause hearing? How did that come into happen? You said you went to a show cause hearing and objected.
The show case.
On March 10th or something?
I was told by the protection order office and the lawyer that had given me advice that there was grounds for it to be dismissed. I had submitted my protection order to the protection order office. That was set for hearing March 10th. The written notice or the written, because I was told, at the time I was served on the 24th, whoever handed me the document quickly left. There were still 2 police officers that were there to escort me off the property with my belongings at that moment without prior notice. And they stuck the documents in my purse or whatever, but he did mention you have to contest this within 10 days. And that is, besides filing my own protection order at the protection order office, I contested the protection order that had just been served on me on the 24th of February.
Can I ask you a separate question? If this court were to assume that based on the proceedings, that the return of service is effective and that you were served. I understand that you don't agree with that, but if this court were to say service was had, could you address the merits of why you think, if this is what you are contending, that the protective order is not supported by the record?
Yes. Do I do that now?
Yes, I'm changing topics if you don't mind. Thank you.
Okay, so no state, according to the U.S. Constitutional Amendment 14, Section 1, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of the citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of liberty, property, life, without due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction and the equal protection of the laws. There was two separate households, and the appellee and the appellant resided in separate households. According to transcript document TP9, the court system said the document was served on address of the protection order. If it was not served, if it was served, then it was on the house, not the appellant. The document was served on the address, not on the person. The appellant was not served the protection order, but to answer your question, actually, on the change of topic, there was not any allegations of domestic abuse as per the as per the purposes of the Protection from Domestic Abuse Act, Nebraska Statute 42903, the terms were defined
Was there an allegation that, that you had attempted to cause or intentionally knowingly caused bodily injury with or without dangerous instrument?
No, Your Honor.
Was there such an allegation? Was there an allegation you placed by means of credible threat another person in fear of bodily injury and so forth?
No, Your Honor.
Was there an allegation that you had engaged in sexual contact and this, that, and the other thing?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And the appellee did not present evidence of a credible threat, and we look to Nebraska Code Statute 42903 and the case Linda N. versus William N. Not only that, but the allegations were too general to support such an order. There was one incident mentioned that mentioned something of verbal nature with mere words. The facts in the appellee did not constitute domestic abuse or the need for protection of domestic abuse as per Statute 42903. Therefore, facts would not support entry or grant a protection order pursuant of Statute 42924. The judge did not grant any other protection orders, and in the cases within the Statute 42903, normally other protection orders are granted if there's factual basis. The appellant assumes the judge granted the protection order based on language, but the respondent shall have an opportunity to show cause why the petition should be dismissed, and the respondent had not been served. The show cause hearing to appear, which the appellant assumes the judge issued a final protection order in less than 10 business days, in which the respondent had an opportunity to request hearing and dismissal of the protection order. The appellant was deprived of due process of law and property. The appellant asked the court to dismiss protection order based on lack of factual evidence supporting order, lack of due process according to the 14th Amendment, and reverse judgment of plain error. Deny the request from the brief of the conclusion of the appellee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Maloney, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, Ms. Partouche. Normally this is the part where I would give you a summary of the facts that I think are relevant. I can't do that in this case because we don't have a record. I'm holding in my hands the entirety of this case, which is two briefs and a transcript. And so because there are no facts that I can discuss substantively with you apart from what's obvious on the face of the transcript, it's my intention to just move on to what I think are the primary legal issues in this case. To briefly address Ms. Partouche's points, which I'm not actually sure properly before the court, but I will argue nonetheless, the service issue. There is a case directly on point on this issue. It's a very old case. The case is called State of Nebraska versus County of Kimball, 1957, and I do not have the reporter number off the top of my head. But essentially, that case mirrors the allegation from Ms. Partouche in this case. I understand her argument to be that the sheriff lied in the service return. And that's essentially what County of Kimball discusses, right? It restates a number of actually much older service cases along similar grounds, right? And what County of Kimball says is that we presume the sheriff as an official performed his duty, right? Because he has an official bond, he has an oath of office, he's presumed to have done those duties under those things. And the only way to rebut or disprove the validity of the service is by clear and convincing evidence. So if that's the standard, which I believe it is, as we sit here today, we look then at the transcript, which is all we have to look at in this case. And what we have is what Justice Castle mentioned, a service return showing personal service on February 22nd at a particular time, and no other evidence regarding service at all. And so without more, I don't think I can or really need to, for that matter, comment more about service. So I will move on from that argument unless someone has questions about it. The second argument relates to what Justice Miller-Lerman inquired about, which is the merits. We don't know a whole lot about the merits in this case except what's in the face of the pleadings, right? I would note for simplicity that the protection order petition in this case is a form document that I understand by statute is drafted or prepared as a form by the Administrative Office of the Courts. And it is the only form, as I understand it, that can be filed in a domestic abuse protection order context. What it has is, frankly, generic allegations that say abuse has occurred, a specific family or household relationship exists, and that there is space provided to give details about the alleged abuse for the petitioner in that case.
So we don't have a, quote, bill of exceptions, correct?
Correct. There is no bill of exceptions.
And we do have the pleading, right, the the petition.
Correct. We have a petition and affidavit.
And the affidavit, right. And so similar to what I have asked the appellant, is the affidavit plus the petition and so forth, does it adequately allege something that would meet the statute 42903?
So it does, Justice Miller-Lerman, and I'll split that argument into three parts. First, it has an allegation, I believe in the very first paragraph, that abuse occurred, and it says the petitioner is the victim of the abuse. There's a provided definition of what that means later on in the document, and then there's details explaining that.
So there's allegations supplied, right, by the appellee of verbal abuse.
Correct. And I think expanding on that brings me to what I would say is part two of that argument. Nebraska is a notice pleading jurisdiction. I won't expand on that here. I know this court's well aware of what that means, and I've argued it in my brief. But the case that I cited to you in my brief that I think is most helpful on this is Vasquez versus CHI. It's a 2019 case. And there's some language in that case that essentially says, even if there's missing factual elements that would be critical to a claim that's at issue, in this case, the domestic abuse protection order, within the definitions of 42-903, as long as what's said could reasonably be expected to lead to evidence that the elements of the claim exist and can be proven at a trial, that's enough. That's a plausible claim. And that's all we have to show in a notice pleading jurisdiction. We also have a statute that says the court's obligation is to construe the pleadings to do substantial justice. And I think that further liberalizes the interpretation of the pleadings here. And so part two essentially is that under our notice pleading statute, we're supposed to do things liberally, and there is enough said here for that allegation of domestic abuse to meet the statutory definition. And then part three essentially is we don't know what happened at trial, but we know there was a trial, and we know there was a judgment based on these pleadings. And I'll point to the rule book. Specifically, I'm thinking of Rule 15, which is Court Rule 6-1115. This court is familiar with the idea that the pleadings can be amended constructively to conform to the evidence. We don't know if that happened here. We don't know what the evidence at trial was. We just know that there was a trial and there was a judgment based on whatever that evidence presented at trial was.
Is the question of the adequacy of the pleading, in your view, even before us in this appeal?
So it's a difficult question to answer, Justice Papik. I guess I think of it in two ways. I don't read Ms. Partouche's brief to say that. I believe what she said is the evidence is insufficient.
Well, what, following up on Justice Papik's question, now we're after the trial, such as it was, right?
Correct. And so,
does the evidence support the protection order? And the only evidence, as I believe we agree, is the transcript.
It does.
Justice. Transcript evidence.
So this court has said for many, many years that the only evidence that can be considered on appeal is what's in the Bill of Exceptions. But the problem here is we have an extremely strict standard of review based on the way this case is presented as a matter of appellate procedure, right? This court, again, since the 1800s, has said when there is no Bill of Exceptions, what we do is we make an analysis of whether the pleadings support the judgment.
So rather than calling it evidence, does that which we have support the order?
It does, and specifically I think there's an aspect of this that's unique to the context of protection orders. So I'll draw a distinction between another case I cited, which is in Re Estate of Radford from 2017. That's a case in which I believe it was this court that said there was no evidence offered or apparent within a bill of exceptions that was prepared that could have supported the request that was made at a trial court level. And so this court reversed and said, go back to the trial court, present some evidence, and then maybe we can talk about this.
Let me ask you a related question, if I could, please. And I'm looking at 42.925, which is to the effect that if the respondent doesn't show up, the court shall issue the protective order.
Yes, Justice, and I want to make sure I answer your first question. So to finish that thought, the thing that's unique about this case is our petition is also an affidavit, and the affidavit itself is evidence, which is what distinguishes this case from Radford.
Okay, thank you.
On the statutory interpretation under 925, I think the language...
shall in particular is
the language
the
means
issue.
What it says. And I think if we wanted to get into the weeds on this argument, we could look at a case called Glantz versus Daniel from 2014. The shall language, this court has noted, isn't always as mandatory as it seems. Sometimes it's discretionary. And the distinction this court drew in Glantz versus Daniel was, is the shall language critical to the disposition of the claim, right? And in that case, if I remember correctly, it's whether the hearing was requested within a certain number of business days in the harassment protection order context. Of course, the number of days has changed since then, but the analysis is the same. And I think this court determined that requesting a hearing in a certain number of days wasn't a critical component of the protection order analysis, and so the language was discretionary in that context. I think the opposite is true here. I think that the allegation to show cause is critical. It is what we're here to talk about in the trial context of a protection order.
So if the petition doesn't offer any factual evidence to support a protection order, the judge doesn't enter an ex parte, the judge sends out a show cause, services had upon the defendant, the defendant doesn't show up, is there a shall enter protection order? Is that required? Even though that factual application has no basis to support it.
So again, Justice Fung, I'll split your question maybe into three different answers if I might. In this case, we don't know precisely what the trial court did, and so I think the trial court's decision must be affirmed for that reason. To answer your question more directly, when the show cause is set and if the court determines that the pleadings are insufficient, it appears to me that as long as the respondent doesn't appear and the petitioner does appear.
So if the allegations or petition and or the affidavit and whatever we have in this record, let's say the allegations are the respondent has poor hygiene, and then you would be looking at this 42-925 and say, she didn't show up. Your court's obliged to issue a protection order.
So to combine the two questions, I do think that that's how
I would rather that you not combine and split out. I would rather that you answer the questions.
My answer to the question is I believe the statute does mandate that decision, but I believe the better rule is for the trial court to perform what I think is its fundamental function. And what I mean by that is it seems to me that if a trial court has any purpose at all, it's to determine what the claims are, determine the applicable legal standards for those claims, and then after receiving some amount of evidence at a trial, to apply those facts that it's found to the law. And I think that if there's a workable rule to be had here, notwithstanding what appears to be mandatory language in the statute you referenced, Justice Miller-Lerman, that that's the rule, that the trial court always has an obligation to get to whether the legal standards can be met by whatever facts are brought out at trial, which should be framed by the police.
That's what you believe. Can you help us at all with, you have some authority for that?
I think that goes, Mr. Chief Justice, to the heart of what the trial court does. I did not brief that issue, and I will admit that I have not specifically researched it, but I'm happy to provide the court with supplemental briefing if that's what you'd like. But
so if we have the application, the petition, it has no factual basis to support it, show cause hearing is set, respondent is served, doesn't show up, the petitioner is unrepresented by counsel, just says, judge, here's my application, they mark it, receive it, offer no evidence, does the judge have a duty then to do further inquiry? Does the judge have to call the petitioner to the stand to question that? And how does a protection order get entered when there's no factual basis supported other than the fact that the application has been filed and service has been had and the respondent doesn't appear?
I would say, Justice Funk, it's correct to frame the question as whether the trial court has a duty. And I think that it's correct to say that it does in an instance like that. I'll point back, if I may answer, Mr. Chief Justice. I see I'm out of time.
Yeah, please finish your thought.
I'll point back at a case that I believe is Mahmoud versus Mahmoud from 2010, right? And that case suggests that an offer of a petition and affidavit, if it's received by the court, in itself can be enough. I think we're talking about the question in which perhaps the affidavit allegations are not enough.
That's exactly the point.
And I think the trial court then has a duty to do some sort of further inquiry, and perhaps that's questioning of the petitioner who should be appearing at that hearing, right? Notwithstanding what the respondent does. And if the court's satisfied by what the petitioner says in that instance, I think then the protection order can be entered. I think it's not entered.
Does the record before us decisively show one way or the other whether the trial court did what you suggest was its duty?
It does not, Justice Castle, and I think ultimately that's where the legal presumptions that I spent a lot of my briefing talking about come into play. We presume a whole lot of things happen when the trial record isn't before us. We presume that the trial court correctly decided questions about evidence. We presume the trial court's decision was correct as a legal matter. We presume that there were sufficient factual findings to support the trial court's decision. And that's been the law for many decades in Nebraska. Because there is no record, and because in this instance the appellant had the burden of preparing the record, as has always been the case with appeals in Nebraska, now I think we're in the realm of talking about invited error. In other words, what I mean is, if it's the appellant's burden to prepare a record upon which this court can find error and reverse or remand in some fashion, it seems odd to suggest that the appellant can win without having prepared a record or done anything at trial, for example, to show that there was an error of service or to show that there was a defect in the merits of what was said in the petition. And so I think that's why, even if this court gets to the merits, we ought to be thinking about the invited error doctrine.
Thank you very much. I don't believe we have any time for rebuttal.
No, Your Honor.
So that concludes arguments in Partouche versus Partouche. Counsel and Ms. Partouche, thank you very much. You are excused. And the court will go on to Avis Rent-A-Car System, Inc. versus McDavid.